This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Red snapper was on the decline for decades in the Gulf of Mexico, and in 2001, federal managers started a plan to rebuild the stocks of the prized fish. That's put limits on how the fish can be caught in federal waters, even as states like Florida allow more and more fishing for red snapper in state waters. Coming up in the second half of our show, we'll talk to a lifelong Florida fisherman and an advisor to the Gulf of Mexico Fisheries Management Council to get the latest on the red snapper controversy and why some Gulf fishermen are preparing to protest over the prized fish. But first, the beloved bright red songbird, the cardinal, is turning up sick in some parts of Florida, but the culprit is not likely any new disease. Wildlife officials say it's most likely the fault of well-meaning humans with bird feeders or bird baths. Meanwhile, alligators are crossing highways and have caused two accidents in the past week, and just this weekend, one found itself in a Venice homeowner's pool. Living in Florida means sunshine, beaches, and never-ending wildlife, but sometimes managing our interaction with the wild animals here needs a little extra attention. Here to talk more about being a responsible bird lover is Dr. Heather Barron with the Crow Clinic for Wildlife. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me. Anytime we get the opportunity to prevent cases from coming in, we're always really happy to do that.
It's always good to get that word out there and to remind people, and plus new people. Also here to talk about the wandering gators haplessly walking towards a speed bump final chapter is Dr. John Herman, the FGCU biology professor. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
We are talking about Florida wildlife, from alligators to songbirds, and how we can be better neighbors for these animals whose territory we encroach upon. Do you have a question or a comment? Give us a call to ask our experts at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we are at WGCU using the hashtag GCO. First, Dr. Heather Barron with Crow. Is this a new phenomenon that we're seeing with songbirds getting sick from bird feeders and bird baths?
Absolutely not. In fact, I think one thing that everybody has in common is if they have bird feeders or baths in their yards, it's because they do love wildlife and want to attract them. But to some degree, you may be loving these animals to death by feeding them, because when animals congregate into smaller areas like at yard feeders, they are at increased risk for disease transmission between one another.
Is it kind of like sending your toddler to daycare?
Exactly. Anytime you have a heavy concentration of animals all in one area, the potential for disease spread is much higher.
So is any of this stuff caused by other animals like squirrels, rats, or raccoons that want to get into that bird feeder?
Certainly it can be. There are a wide variety of diseases that are commonly spread at feeders. Bacterial diseases such as salmonella, which is what we're seeing the cardinals die from, mycoplasma, which was a huge outbreak problem a number of years ago, particularly in house finches and sparrows, lots of fungal diseases, parasitic diseases, viral diseases. So certainly you really can have a problem, particularly if you're using feeders that are difficult to disinfect, like wooden feeders.
Oh, wooden bird feeders are kind of tough to disinfect?
Exactly.
So going more for the plastic or glass?
Exactly, yes. Things that would easily be scrubbed clean and disinfected.
Mm-hmm. So some of this is birds or animals passing stuff from one to the other, but then some of it's just developing in the feeder or the bird bath.
That's exactly right. You know, particularly this time of year, with it being a lot warmer, bacterial things proliferate very easily in warm, moist conditions. And so we definitely see that as being a bigger concern. And also fungal things like aspergillosis are a big problem around feeders this time of year.
So this time of year is definitely bad because it's just so hot and humid.
That's exactly
what we see. Does it make the seed go bad faster?
It certainly does, particularly if the seed gets moist at all. That's where we can often have fungus growing and some pretty nasty bacterial things as well. So it's important to not only clean your feeders routinely, but also to rake up any fallen seed that's in the area on the ground.
And also clean up around there, because there are other things that birds do when they're sitting there on the feeder too, like
what goes in must come out.
Yeah, and down around the bottom is where it all just kind of sits. So turning now to more reptilian neighbors, Dr. John Herman, you're the biology professor here at FGCU who seems to find himself on a call when there's a wandering gator on campus. Did you see the video of the one walking through the quad?
Yes, I did see that.
Yeah, that was pretty nice. That one went viral.
Yeah.
This is where I work, and here goes this alligator. So what's making these animals move around in places they don't normally go this time of year?
This time of year is the introduction of the wet season, so we're just transferring into that wet season part of our Florida seasonal system. And when it gets so dry, especially this year, it's been extremely dry for a long time, there's just no water, and so they have to seek them out in places that normally they wouldn't go. So retention ponds, swimming pools, any place that we design as humans to retain the water, they're going to seek that out for food, for cooling down and things like that. So they're on the move a lot.
So when the water level goes down, it's been a really super dry season, and these ponds get shorter and shorter and smaller, do they get crowded out sometimes from these ponds?
Oh, absolutely, yeah, especially if there's a larger gator that's moving around and they get into a pond. Any current residents that might be smaller would need to move. They're very territorial in that sense, and they would the larger one would have no problem exerting some dominance.
It's kind of a pecking order, I suppose, yeah. Right? To loop in the bird conversation. So every year we hear news stories about gators that make a new home for itself in a backyard pool. Is it okay for an alligator to be in a chlorinated pool? Would he not notice the difference?
I'm sure that there would be a difference noticed. Would it hurt them? Probably not in the short term. They have very impervious skin, so it's not going to seep in like an amphibian that would take in the chemicals and it would hurt them really badly. They don't tend to drink a lot of water once they're in there. If there was something for them to eat, that would be a different story. So if they ate something in the pool, they would certainly ingest some of that water, which might not be good for them. Long term, it would be bad. But short term,
eventually,
they probably wouldn't notice it.
Now, if you, for example, you're out of town for 3 months, would an alligator, if he got into a pool, would he ever leave on his own?
Oh, yeah. I'm pretty sure that especially with a pool, if an alligator found its way into a pool, it wouldn't stay there too long. It's not a natural habitat. It's not going to have cover. It's not going to have food. It's not going to have the things that it would normally want. So while it sought that pool out for the water, there's nothing else there for it. So
yeah, there's
leave.
Nothing to eat.
Right. So yeah. It would eventually leave.
Unless it gets that little floating chlorinated tablet.
Right, right.
So once you have an alligator that's been in a pool and then the authorities, the proper authorities, not anybody's own personal alligator wrangling self or
right.
uncle, actually came in and removed it, once that alligator's out of the water, is it safe to get in that water?
Yeah, I would say you should probably clean it, maybe shock it, maybe do a partial water change. But – just from a temporary alligators in, alligators out fairly quickly, there probably won't be much of an issue with water cleanliness afterwards.
Yeah, it just kind of gives you the willies though.
Yeah.
So you've been the guy who removes alligators from the midst of student areas. For example, you're taking them out of the South Village pond and then over into larger ponds here on campus.
Yes.
Once you move them, are they generally okay with their new pond?
So we've been tracking that now for about the last 5 years. I've moved about a dozen alligators from some of the smaller ponds that are in student-heavy areas, either Sovie ponds or the library pond, things like that, and moved them to some of the less populated area ponds. I can't say that I've actually seen them stay or go. We're not actually doing like radio telemetry on them. I have had one alligator that I moved about 3/4 of a mile away, and the next day I found him back in the Sovie pond. So sometimes they just have a really good home. Now, the Sovie pond, the one right in front of the cafeteria area there, is one where a lot of gators always congregate because students continue to feed them from that observation deck. And they're not willing to give up that perfect habitat. It's got good water. It's got good cover. And they get free food.
They get free food they don't have to work for.
Right. So one of some of these issues of alligators coming into retention ponds, particularly like that Sovie pond, is about education. We need people to understand that feeding wildlife, while it attracts them, just like with the birds, it has negative consequences. Particularly with the alligators, they start to associate humans with food. And that's where negative interactions can start to happen.
Yeah. It's not bad having a cardinal hanging around because you're feeding it, but having an alligator
right.
hanging around. I mean, they're cute when they're like a foot or two long, but they don't stay cute. for too long. In fact, it's kind of questionable. No, and then I wanted to ask also about mating seasons. I mean, a lot of people say, oh, the alligators are on the move because it's mating season. Is it or is it not? Or is it even possible to pin that down?
It's slightly difficult here in South Florida being in our subtropical environment. There is a mating season. This is around that time, but it's fairly fluid here. We don't have a hard winter or any kind of dedicated seasonal system that would drive that as much as, say, maybe even 100 miles north of here. So, yeah, there is a mating season, but it can be fluid.
Yeah, they're opportunists, so,
yes.
I suppose. Are there any other reptiles or amphibians that are on the move and possibly finding themselves face-to-face with humans or presenting a danger to humans or their pets right now?
Same thing would hold for just about all of them right now. With water being scarce, things are going to seek out wherever that water is. One of the animals that we are tracking and have been tracking for the last year or so on campus are the eastern diamondback rattlesnakes. And this time of year, they're fairly active in moving. They're very secretive. You probably will not see them unless they are crossing a path or a road, which makes them obvious. If they're moving through the underbrush, you're not going to find them. You're not going to see them. You won't even notice they're there. Your dogs, on the other hand, if they're not on a leash, are very good at picking up those senses, and they will stick their nose in, and that's where problems can start. This is a large snake, a venomous snake. Its whole reliance on camouflage and ambush prey or hunting, that's its strategy. So it's not going to run away like, say, a black racer might. So if a dog sticks its nose in, they're going to stand their ground a little bit. And if it does and gets a bite, yeah, it could be a serious situation for a pet. This also holds true for gardeners, or if you're weeding or doing any kind of lawn work, sticking your hands into areas that are high weeds or under brush. Pygmy rattlesnakes are similar to the eastern diamondback in that they're kind of a stay-at-home, rely on camouflage.
We have those here too?
We do. And
great.
They
we have
can
two
be
kinds
nippy.
Of I have learned something. We have two different kinds of rattlesnakes.
We do.
Oh.
Yeah.
So what kind of bites are these? Are these fatal?
Usually the pygmy rattlesnake is not going to be a fatal bite. You're not going to enjoy it. It's going to be very painful. They do have a hemotoxin in their venom, so you'll get necrosis, which means your skin, your flesh, your tissue would start to die back. It is serious. It's not something that you should just sleep it off.
But is it a bigger problem then for a smaller dog?
Because
it's a smaller
be.
System?
Honestly, dogs and cats, and you can help me with this as well, they tend to handle venom a little bit better than humans. They don't seem to be as adversely affected. That's not saying that they do not experience any pain or trauma. But the bites that I've seen that have happened on dogs and cats versus the bites I've seen on human hands, it seems to break down our tissues quite a bit faster. I'm not quite sure why that is.
Well, that's odd. So Dr. Heather Barron with Crow, are there any other animals that you know of that might be on the move right now that could – I don't know about be dangerous, but be also impacted negatively by human beings?
Well, certainly there is a lot of turtles that are moving around this time of year, and some of those can potentially be dangerous to humans. The snapping turtles, really any turtle can potentially bite. So if you do see a turtle crossing the road, the best thing to do is really just leave it alone and let it go ahead and cross the road. If you feel like you need to pick it up to decrease the chances of it being hit by a car, you need to be very careful about the way that you do that and make sure you move it in the direction that it was already going.
What's the proper way to pick up a turtle if you are actually going to go out there and do it? Just pick it up around the outside?
As far back as your hands can go, there are certain species of turtle that can still bite you if you're picking them up from the sides. So in many cases, we'll grasp them at the base of the tail and then slide our hand underneath the bottom shell and pick them up that way. So you're not picking them up by the tail, but you're using a hold on the tail to prevent them from crawling away from you.
And you slide your hand under the belly is the best way?
Exactly.
And then deliver it like you're delivering a tray? Of
exactly,
food or something,
yes.
Right? Oh, man. Is there any way to like, you know, kind of urge them along or stand kind of so that people see you?
Yeah, if you approach them, and then in all likelihood, their defense in many cases is to sort of sit down and pull everything in and get ready to defend themselves. So again, the best thing to do is generally stay in your car and just let them go ahead and finish crossing the road.
Yeah. We are talking about Florida wildlife and the unique interactions that happen this time of year. Do you have a question or comment? Give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. And we do have a caller on the line. This is Warren from Cape Coral who has a question. Warren, what would you like to ask?
Well, there's a bird bath out back, and I keep on refilling it, cleaning up every, just about every day. But I've noticed that there's a variety of kind of allergies that grow on anything from like a brownish red to kind of a blackish or a blackish green. And I was kind of wondering if any of those are nasty and whether I should even use chlorine on the thing.
That's a really good question. And I wanted to get to care and maintenance of a bird bath. Now, how do you do that? What do you suggest people do?
You absolutely should clean that. If you're seeing algae growing, that is an indication that the bath is probably to the point where it needs to be cleaned. And using a delete bleach solution should work very well to do that. So usually about just a few tablespoons of bleach to a cup or so of water should be the right concentration. So you're looking for about a 10% bleach solution. And you leave that in contact with the bird bath for about 10 minutes. And then you can go ahead and rinse that off, allow it to dry out, and then refill it. And the water should be both safe and much cleaner for the animals.
So how often do you think you should do that?
Really, however often it looks like your bird feeder needs it, so it's going to depend a lot on how heavy a usage your bird feeder or bird bath is getting, but I would say a minimum of once a week.
So is there a preferred material for a bird bath? I mean, is it possible for like the concrete ones? Are they more porous? Do they get more, you know, crud in there? Or the plastic ones? What do you think is the best kind?
The concrete is a little more porous, but that is pretty much the standard bird bath. And again, any of them would clean up fine. If it looks dirty to you, it's time to clean it. And many people will clean their baths every day, and that would be ideal.
Is it better to have a running fountain that has water that's moving instead of stagnant?
It absolutely is better to have moving fountain water, and you'll notice that birds are more attracted to that as well.
Oh, well, that's kind of nice. At least, of course, that's going to require an electrical situation too, correct? All right. We are talking about Florida wildlife and the unique interactions that happen this time of year. If you have a question or comment, feel free to give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. And we're talking about bird bath care and maintenance. What do you need to do with a bird feeder? Do you have to empty that out, put in fresh seed every so often?
Yeah, that would be ideal. Again, it depends on the time of year and how heavy a usage you're getting, how often you need to clean that feeder and change the seed out, maybe anywhere from every week to every month. But certainly every month at a minimum, those feeders need to be all the seed emptied out and everything cleaned.
So if you have like a wild spot, do you just dump the wild seed just out there, or do you just put it in your trash? Or
yeah, usually in trash cans is going to be the best way to dispose of that.
And then do you need to use that kind of 10% bleach solution again also with the bird feeders?
Exactly.
Okay. And that's going to be easier with the non-wood feeders.
Yeah. And if you see that there are birds in your yard that look like they're not healthy, they're fluffed up, depressed, sitting down on the ground, if they have any lumps or bumps or obvious abnormalities, those can all be indications that they're suffering from some type of disease and that your bird feeder may be playing a large role in that. In that case, it's better to just take your feeders and baths out of commission for about 2 weeks and get them nice and clean and then start over again. And that will hopefully give the area birds a little bit of a break from congregating in places where they're more likely to pick those things up. And if you see an animal that's down and you're concerned about it, please give us a call at Crow and we can advise you on how to seek help for that individual.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. How can you tell a bird is not feeling well? He just kind of stays on the ground?
Yeah, if you approach the bird and it doesn't fly away, then it probably needs to be seen by a veterinarian.
Okay, and then they call and you come out. You don't try to pick it up yourself?
It depends on the animal. Some people are comfortable about picking that animal up themselves. In other cases, we will dispatch a VERT, which is a volunteer emergency rescue and transport person from Crow to come to get the animal.
Yeah, cardinal's a little less dangerous than trying to pick up an ailing alligator,
yes.
Definitely. We have another phone call from Michael in Fort Myers. Michael, what would you like to ask?
Yeah, hi. I'm just curious because we have a snake hole by our front door.
Uh-huh.
But we didn't notice we had a snake hole near our front door until after we started putting bird feeders out there. So I don't know if it's the time of year that snakes just come out of their holes, or if it's the bird feeder adding to the nutrients for the snakes to have. Maybe it's just easy food.
Well, that's a good question. That would be a great one for you, Dr. Herman. Do you think that snakes can ID a bird feeder and find that there's more birds there and they want to get after them?
Oh, absolutely. That's one of the things with bird feeders and bird baths is that they can become a predator trap, not only from snakes but things like Cooper's hawks and other avian predators. They rather enjoy you setting up the bird feeder for them so that they can pick off the songbirds. With the snakes, would they cue in on the bird feeder and then create a home? Probably not. There are probably other things that would help them. Holes near the foundation of a house are always great places for snakes because it's a thermal relief, especially this time of year. It's hot. It's starting to get wet, but it's still dry. They can overheat really quickly. So finding a nice place to get in or under your house is actually pretty attractive to them from a thermal perspective, not necessarily from food.
So in this situation, it might have been a coincidence.
Right. But while they're there, they're certainly not above taking advantage of the fact that there might be birds who may be potentially sick from the bird feeder and a little bit slower, and nature will take its place.
Yeah, it's like a buffet. And I wanted to ask also, are bird feeders necessary in Florida? I mean, do birds need that seed?
Not only do birds not need it, but ideally for the health of the animals, it's better to not provide it. Having said that, I feel like, we're always trying to balance the beauty of having birds in your yard. We love it when people connect with wildlife because I feel like what you don't know or don't see very often, you can't care about. And so I really appreciate that because people do love wildlife, that they want to see that wildlife up close, and that is certainly something a bird feeder can do for you. But ideally, for the health of the animals, bird feeders are not the best idea. And they're also not necessarily the best idea for your health. Remember, many of these diseases that are making the birds sick can make people sick as well. So please be sure, if you are cleaning these feeders or baths, that you're wearing gloves and that you're washing up very carefully afterwards.
That's a really interesting point you bring up. And then I wanted to also ask, up north, you think in the wintertime of these poor birds that don't have anything to eat. Here, it's not winter. We don't have snowstorms and there's always stuff. But do birds depend on bird feeders up north?
Well, that's an excellent point. And another reason why we actually don't think bird feeders are the best idea is because birds often will delay their migration in order to continue to take advantage of an abundant food source. And then often they stay too late and get caught by the winter. So it's just another way that sometimes feeders can actually hurt the very animal that you're trying to love and help. Certainly, if they live in the north throughout the winter, then they've evolved to be able to survive in those conditions without the help of people, and it would be more ideal to not feed them.
Yeah, it's kind of a tough one because you want people to be near them and appreciate them and still love them and support them and support the rescue efforts for them too, like Crow, for example. But then you kind of don't want to encourage people to do too much to then, potentially hurt them.
Exactly. We really, again, appreciate that people do love wildlife. And I love this opportunity to kind of educate people about this issue because ideally at Crow, as a nonprofit interested in wildlife health and promoting wildlife health, we would love to see people taking an active role in preventing some of these problems. We all know Mother Nature doesn't pay her bills. So for us at Crow, it's actually better if the patients don't come in. So we definitely appreciate you guys out there listening and taking heed of this message.
Yeah. And then we talked a little bit about how the bird feeders can cause them to be dependent. Do bird baths offer any of the similar things? That's just kind of ornamental and not as big of a deal.
It depends on where you live. If you live out in the Southwest, for example, that may be a huge attractant for them. And as we've pointed out in the show, it's been the dry season. It is very dry right now. And water can almost be as big attractant as food this time of year.
Yeah, and they need that. We have a question coming in from Will Ward. I'm sorry, that's not Will. We needed to ask a question, I'm sorry, from Lynn. Lynn, did you have a question? Sorry, I don't have the right person. Okay, I'm sorry. Never mind. We'll get to Lynn in a minute, but I think she's talking with someone. So I wanted to go now to Dr. John Herman. FDCU has more than 700 acres of property. So what animals are here that people might not know about besides those rattlers?
Oh, we have a huge number, a wonderful biodiversity here on campus. And some of the animals you might be surprised to know are here are the megafauna, so big animals that you don't normally see. I have a number of students doing research projects with wildlife cameras set up all over campus. And we regularly get black bear on campus, Florida panther on campus, lots of bobcats. We have a very healthy population of bobcats on campus, which is fun because although I've seen all those pictures and I'm out there walking through those conservation areas daily, in my 6 years here, I still have yet to see a bobcat, a panther, or a bear on campus. But on my cameras, I see them almost daily. So I know they're there, but
are they showing up daily?
Yes. Yeah, we see them quite a bit, actually. And a lot of that over the last year is probably due to the human development just to our south, so the new Miramar University Village going in.
Yeah, there's been a lot of construction around.
Yeah, that kind of whatever wildlife was in that area then gets pushed into whatever areas are left for them to go into. And we have about 400 acres of conservation land here on FGCU's campus. This is a great place for them to go.
Are they going to get crowded, though?
They will, especially those megafauna. That's simply not enough. 400 acres is not enough for a couple black bear, a couple Florida panther. It's
yeah, panthers need several
miles. It's going to
be difficult,
yes. Right? So it's great that our campus is here and can be used as a corridor to maybe some larger tracts of land. But as we continue our development, those corridors get cut off and all of a sudden you get those wildlife interactions with humans.
Yeah. And we do have Lynn on the line. Lynn has a question. What would you like to ask?
I'd like to find out, we know the problems with habituation with alligators and their association with people and food source. Does that, when you have a bird feeder, does that ever, is there any evidence that that might happen with some birds as well?
You mean causing a bird to be in an area that it shouldn't be?
No. Just habituating the humans a little bit too much where it could cause a danger to them. I just don't know if that ever has happened to birds or not, just by having a bird feeder around. Yeah, they get used to people seeing, you know, putting seed in and, you know, are they more comfortable being around humans, which might be a problem.
Okay, that's a good question for Dr. Barron.
Certainly, it is another reason why you might want to consider not having feeders. Although wildlife may not directly associate people with that food, you will find when they have an excellent food source like they get at feeders, they're not so quick to flee when they see people approaching, and they may become habituated through that method versus with gators where if you're feeding them directly, they definitely associate people with food. And birds and other wildlife as well, if you're feeding them directly from your hand, then that certainly will habituate them to people, and that definitely is a concern. And there's some excellent studies going on in Florida right now looking at the increase of salmonella in wild birds such as ibis, who hang out a lot in parks where humans hang out a lot and they get fed by those humans. We're finding that there is quite a number of bacteria associated with those birds that are the same type of bacteria that are making people sick. So it is definitely never a good idea to feed the wildlife for many reasons, including your own health.
Yeah, and that was getting to a question I was going to ask you. If there are any illnesses, not just the salmonella, but other illnesses that humans are unwittingly passing along when they're trying to do the feeding by hand thing.
Absolutely. So other bacteria like Campylobacter and E. coli, so some very nasty bacterial infections that certainly can make people very sick. Potentially it can spread from the person to wildlife and potentially back again.
So are birds the most susceptible?
Not necessarily.
As far as like a delicate constitution? I mean, that they would be more susceptible to these kind of things?
No, not necessarily. Any wildlife potentially is susceptible. And so we also see other diseases, parasitic diseases like trichomonas, that again are being passed from bird to reptile to mammal to human and back around again. So again, anywhere you have wildlife and people sort of living cheek to cheek, there is potential for disease transmission. And we can certainly minimize that by not feeding our wildlife.
And Dr. Herman, are there any instances of these kinds of things where humans are accidentally making alligators sick or snakes or having any impact on them that way?
Oh, there's quite a bit of evidence that whenever we are interacting with wildlife, we can introduce all kinds of wonderful new diseases, and parasitic disorders are a big one. One of the things I'm actually studying right now in Cape Coral is this interaction between gopher tortoises and people's dogs. So the gopher tortoises love to hang out in these vacant lots in Cape Coral. They're a perfect habitat for them. They proliferate like you would not believe. Lots of gopher tortoises out there. And when people are walking their dogs, they let the dog go into the vacant lot and do its business, but it's a vacant lot. So there's no real reason to pick up the poop once it's there. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we've now, and I'm writing this up at the moment, I think this is a new potential disease vector, the tortoises go in and then they eat that poop. And I've been taking fecal samples from the tortoises and a sample from the actual poop that was deposited by the snake or the dog, and they have the same parasites. And these are parasites that are not typically found in reptiles. So this could be a new disease vector for the gopher tortoises, which already have some other disease issues that they're dealing with in a more natural sense that could hurt this population. And this is a state-threatened species, so this is one that we need to keep an eye on.
Wow, that's really interesting. I would never have really thought about that. That angle. Well, we're going to have to leave it there for now, but I want to thank our guests, Dr. Heather Barron with Crow Clinic and Dr. John Herman, FGCU biology professor. Thank you both for being here. I really appreciate it. It's been enlightening.
Thank you so much for having us.
Coming up, Red Snapper is the fish at the heart of a growing protest by fishermen across the Gulf of Mexico. We'll dig into the controversy and what it means for fishermen and boat captains in Southwest Florida. I'm Julie Glenn. This is Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.